This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 4th of December, 1953. The title of this lecture is LRH Questions the Class on Exteriorization. This tape is 64 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
This is December.
December the 4th, first afternoon lecture. This afternoon, undo checkup with you as to reverse the flow this afternoon. Do checkup with you as to how you're exteriorizing people. And we're starting with you.
With me?
Yeah, how do you exteriorize somebody?
The first three steps, as you have them listed in. Given them to us in clinical procedure. Mm-hmm. First starts out with, where are you not? Where are you not thinking? And locate the person.
Now I ask you another question.
Yes.
I ask you how you exteriorize somebody.
How you exteriorize them? You've got to collect them together first. Mm-hmm. And
getting real interesting.
Scare him out of his head anyway and get him out.
Doing very, very interesting. Now tell me how to exteriorize somebody.
Asking him to be back in bed.
That's right. That's
right. Or backing him out.
Right. All right. So there's somebody out of his head. Okay. Now how do you exteriorize somebody who says he's there, he guesses, he doesn't know? What do you say at that moment? Do you say at that moment, you're there, you know you're there, you see this club? Or do you audit according to newer methods? How do you do that? What do you do then?
You're checking by, are you in your ear, or nose, mm-hmm. back of your eyes, so on and so forth. Pretty soon you're getting backed out.
No. What do you do at that point? We got him out, more or less. He doesn't know. He isn't quite sure. What do we do then?
He isn't giving him a certainty that he's not where he said he is. Where he says he isn't.
It's about time we have this lecture. You run SOP8C.
Oh.
Oh.
After you get him out.
No matter how uncertainly he is out, SOP8C takes care of the remainder. Matter of fact, it will back him out without asking him out. But that's asking too much. Now, let me make a little note. There's one slight difference to there that possibly may have escaped you. You ask him if he is out. Now, this appears to be one of those nonsensical questions. You say B3, beat back your head, and he says yes. And he does a lot of other things and says yes. It might occur to you to be a non-essential step to say, are you back of your head? That might occur to you to be entirely non-essential. But believe me, it's so essential that a step one preclear who audits like a breeze, like waving a small stick through the air, I mean, there's nothing to it, went five sessions in the hands of an auditor who's otherwise a good auditor, getting pictures of himself as a Thetan, doing these things. The boy had a slight case of using viewpoints, the mildest case of using viewpoints imaginable, and it had just never occurred to him that he could be 3 feet back of his head. He was sold on what is laughingly called modern science, to the point where he knew he was a body. And as soon as it was explained to him, I wanted him, personality, him, a being, 3 feet back of his head, he put another being back there and threw that one away. But I'm a body, he said. And so I said, well, on what course, obviously a very mild case, on what course were you instructed that you were a body? So did you ever take science in high school? Yes, majored in it. There we go. I simply straight wired, just on that little point alone, back to third grade hygiene. thinking I'm rerunning. And heaved him out with main strength and awkwardness. He said, "Now to hell with it. You're not a body. Be 3 feet back of your head." So he says, "Well, all right." Then he says, well, you know, not. This was a boy, young boy. You could do that with him. And I just shortened up the whole thing just with a very rapid straight wire. And then without arguing any further, just told him to be back there. And he discovered his certainty immediately. Now, the point I'm making here is that the boy had been audited five times, five long sessions, to remedy a condition, something somebody never should have started auditing him on, you see. They shouldn't have started auditing this boy to remedy a condition. Exteriorized him so he could fix up something. Wrong goal. Entirely wrong goal. So the goal involved here is to make a theta clear. The theta clear has nothing to do with making somebody minus an ingrown toenail. Because the way to fix him up so you don't remedy an ingrown toenail is to audit him for an ingrown toenail. That's a fact. Because you validated the condition. That's the first reason why not. And the second reason why is you're asking him to get into shape a piece of mess. So you certainly better have a being that can handle mess. All right. Now we got that? So that little question is inserted in there. Now we will go over this all over again. How do you exteriorize somebody?
3 feet.
That's right. That's right. Are you there? And if he is, he says, "Well, whether I am or not, I don't know." What do you do?
Negative location.
What do you do?
Oh, start out with clinical procedure, step number one.
That's right. That's right. Now let's go over again.
Are you confined? Are you there? Clinical, right. Step number one.
That's right. What other steps, clinical? That's right. Now, sometimes for the sake of randomity, when somebody's fairly certainly back of his head, why, I'll skip a step and then go back and get it. When the person's worried about something specific, and I think it'll speed things up or something, that's all right. Okay, skip a step and then go back and get it later. So he tells you immediately, "Yes, I'm 3 feet back of my head, but you know the room keeps going this way." You say, "Okay, put up 8 anchor points to hold it straight." Don't put them up there. Got it there. And then go on. But it is a problem which can use a great deal of judgment on the part of an auditor. But I would say when you've exteriorized 50 or 100 people, why, you will know how to do it faster than SOPHC. You know how to do it faster after you exteriorize 50 or 100 people. All right. Now let's go over it again. How do you exteriorize something?
2 feet behind your head.
That's right. And what do you do then?
Are you there?
Mm-hmm. And he says no.
And he says no. Start in on negative location. Step number 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3, 1, 2, and 3 until he is 3 feet.
That's right. But after he's done step 1, 2, and 3, and 1, 2, and 3, then what do you do? He's still on 3 feet back.
He's still on.
What do you do then?
There's a problem of either space or havingness.
He's hanging on the body. That's obvious. He's not 3 feet back of his head. That's the first conclusion you could make. Now, what's wrong with him? What else is wrong with him?
He won't get out.
Well, what's wrong with him yet? You've been through him 3 times and he's still locked out. What's still wrong with him?
At that time, it's the auditor's wrong.
There's two things wrong with him. That's right. There's still 2 things wrong with him. Which boil down to 1 thing wrong with him. And you said it, pattiness. The other one wrong with him is, of course, what follows with pattiness. Space. Leave that. Would you let me shake you off?
Well, I don't know what hidden secret.
That's mean of me, isn't it?
Yes.
That's real mean. You gave me the right answer. All right. Know when you know, will you? Now, the first 3 steps, to a large degree, though, the way I'm putting them together right this minute, I have put enough emphasis on those 2 points as we go through it that the probability of somebody still being in his head after the first 3 steps are run, it's getting very slight. But supposing he is still on his head, now what do you do?
He's hanging on to the body.
Hmm.
You gotta find out why he's hanging on. There's some fault or some loss in his life that's been too much. Discover what that is.
You
need
it, and you can
work on that.
Mm-hmm. Good. What else might you do?
Some effect that he's had, emotional effect, and then placed around walls.
You got that cared for in the first 3 steps. Although, this probably shouldn't be on a tape, but the most famous case, the most famous case we've got, if not here, not in this unit, the most, you know, when you go, we tried to cover them up, but those blood stains, which you see in the hall, where 726, are places where auditors have blown their brains out over this case. On this decision from the auditor, put fear into those walls. And as far as I'm concerned, you're going to be doing that for the next 40 hours.
Yeah.
The case exteriorized. This case carried along, look at you sadly. Sadly. Now, did the session do you any good? He'd look at you sadly. He was always with that quiet voice. But this is easily the most famous and the worstest case I ever saw or confronted. Anyways, not in terms of sanity. This guy's eminently sane. He just couldn't get out of his head. That is impossible. Okay. Now, what you would do would be, to some degree, establish if there was some weird, possible, stuck-up, gummed-up reason. That's right, because you've got a case, obviously, that's dealing with a reason as very senior to everything else. You e-meter them. But there's even another way of doing it. I'm going to tell you about that today. That's very good. Thank you very much. You know your answers were all wrong, don't you?
Yes, sir.
You realize they're all wrong. That's very interesting.
the establishment of a certainty by repetition of action is a step which shouldn't be necessary to an auditor. But before he is in real good condition as a theta clear, it happens to be, at this time, necessary. After he's thrown a few people out of their heads and squared them up, he has no doubt about what he's doing. And auditors are now starting to get back rather directly from pre-clears, the exact, rather uniformly, the exact effect that is the reason why the technique is being used. In other words, we technique used, reason why it shows up instantly, the same reason why as you've been getting right here. You know, the fellow comes to the conclusion these things are hitting rather uniformly. After you've exteriorized a few people, you'll know what you're doing. Very, very well know what you're doing. What do you do after you get a pre-clear out of his head?
Out of his head? Well, that differs with the pre-clear.
You what?
Differs slightly with the pre-clear.
Uh-huh. What do you do?
Well, I do what I think is good at the particular time.
Good. What do you do?
Mainly, yes, that'd be dangerous places, familiar places.
What else do you do?
I go on to SOP.
What have you been doing that was necessary to vary this? What problems have you run into in the people you've been exteriorizing necessitated a variation from what you've gotten here in the last couple of weeks?
I'm afraid I must admit candidly that there's no need for any variation from his SOPA.
Well, you must admit that candidly. Are you saying that to be safe or because it's a fact?
No, I'm saying it because I believe it to be a fact.
That's right. I shouldn't put this on tape either, but asking what you did after you got a PC out of his head, he looked at me very blankly. And he was auditing three very difficult cases. And he was getting results on these cases. Maybe not with the speed he should, but he was getting results. What he was doing was probably exactly applying theory to the operation of a case. He was getting his results. And of course, actually, that's very good auditing. No doubt about that, but it hadn't occurred to him to codify the thing. However, what we have here, and what we've done, as far as practice is concerned, 8C, he's talking about use 8, all right, that's good. 8C takes the theory, and there it is. I mean, that's the theory. Only you use it in practice. That's the slight advance. It's almost direct. For instance, it's inherent. I mean, you couldn't run on orienting straight wire. You couldn't run that without seeing that his mental condition depended to a great degree upon his ability to find himself, which means orientation was the knee plus ultra as far as this case was concerned, and that must be an operating process of existence which is senior to many others. And now you can't go down and the same step and start throwing barriers and emotions around for the next step, and throw barriers, emotions, and so forth, and start handling those without recognizing that he was actually dealing with a problem of barriers. First location, and then location amongst barriers. I mean, it was just pile up. And then with the time you get to step three, you've got space problems. And as soon as you've got these problems of space, it must be obvious that the Satan is terrifically dependent upon space. And that he's dependent on it in very peculiar ways. And the three universes are sitting in there right straight through. So here we go. And if you did apply direct theory, just as it's been dug up and laid out here, you would just get SOPHC. I mean, that's all you'd get. Good.
Ron, before I came here, just as a relief, after I'd done all the heavy work, I would say to the pretty Clara, okay, we're going to end this session. Now, give me your hand and let's walk on air. Oh, this is wonderful. I was anchoring that pretty clear that he wasn't afraid. I didn't even know that was exteriorizing. Now I see it. Give me your hand and let's walk on air. And one day, a woman, she wasn't being processed. She was in a group. And she said, oh, no, you don't. And the woman had cancer. But couldn't we do it in our sessions here? Ron, you get it. Give me your hand and let's walk on air. And we could say, oh, this is wonderful. Well, isn't that it? Then go alone. You see, the first time, give me your hand. I didn't know what I was doing.
Give me a hand.
Yeah, give me your hand and let's walk on air.
You could, except the preclears who are in real good shape don't move. They don't move. Asking a preclear to move will sometimes bog him down, so you have that liability there.
They go out doing wonderful.
Well, I know, but what percentage? Now, when we're gunning for the whole bank, you ask an awful lot of preclears to move, and you're going to have a lot of difficulty. I got a hold of the case once. That's quite interesting. I got a hold of the case once on that. Now, I want to make this differentiation right when it comes up. It's B, 3 feet back here. It's not move, 3 feet back. B, 3 feet back. Ran into a preclear who was all bogged down, had been out a couple of times and was never out no more no how. And was very upset about the whole thing. And come find out, he had been moved. It was step one, but he'd been moved out of his head, and ever since he'd been trying to move, and he'd never moved before, you see. And it had keyed him in all over the place.
But that's not the same thing, Ron.
Yeah, I know, but you're still asking him to move.
Yeah, but I'm going with him. See, let's walk on air.
All right.
So he doesn't feel alone.
Sure. This is perfectly good theory.
Then the next time, now I know what to do after that, you see. He's had a taste of it then.
Mm-hmm.
He says, oh, that's wonderful.
You want your preclear to be places. Not making that a differentiation.
Yeah.
Now let's get it very clear. We want him to be places. We don't want him to go into locomotion through places to obtain places. Because the second you ask your preclear to do this, if the preclear is about step level 3 or 4, you're liable to key him on this. The distance is too great. To walk to it is impossible. To walk through space is the one thing he can't bear to do. Now, distance is the enemy of havingness. And so we get him to move through the air, and a preclear who is at about 3 or 4, it might occur to him for the first time that he was moving. And if he thinks he's got to move outside, that's why we get away with it on a lot of cases. The sweeper that's in there, that's why we get away with just popping him out. And then being places. See, be here, be there. Whereas this case had been moving from one place to another, you see. Been moving along from one place to another. Arduously and horribly. The distance is so great is a facet and an important one of havingness. Now, to get this idea for a moment, you see what it is. Let's get the idea of somebody 150 miles from here with a $10 bill that he will give you if you walk down there. No. Now let's get the idea of having to walk down to the corner for lunch. Now, some preclears that this would hit get the weariest feeling. They've got to move something or expend some energy in order to possess. And they don't and won't do it. As a consequence, they just anchor themselves in one place with the havingness they've got, pull in everything that they can pull in, and don't move. It's because they feel they have to move that they anchor in their heads. See, because havingness. In order to have more havingness, they feel they would have to move to some other place. And the feeling of motion will require effort, and this effort they cannot expend. Thus, distance is the thing which is the nearest enemy to heaviness for such a person. It needn't be at all. He just thinks it is. That is definitely an aberration. You see, he can be here and then be in San Francisco, and actually be in San Francisco. And if he's real good, make the clock in the ferry building stop or something. I mean, he'd be in San Francisco, all right. And then be here again. In what space of time? Well, just about as short a space of time as you care to make a space of time. Now, when he's real, real good, he can be here and be in San Francisco, too. Now, that's getting real sharp. And then he can also be in Seattle. Now, this is an interesting development. This is scarcity of me, you know, that runs out. He's running out of scarcity of me. There's only one me. He's awfully sold on that idea. It doesn't happen to be a correct idea at all. The first time you take somebody that you think you have nicely polished up, and they're faded clear, and you say, all right, now be here. Now be in San Francisco. He is in San Francisco, you know. And then he's here, and then he is in San Francisco. And then he's here. Now you say, now, let's get this now. Let's stay here and be in San Francisco. He'll put a viewpoint in San Francisco. You say, no, 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 no. Be here and be in San Francisco. He says, both places at once? What are you trying to do to me? Tear me to pieces? And you say, yup. And you work with him for a while, and you do it on a gradient scale. You don't process somebody that way. I just said if you ask somebody, that would be the result. If you do it on a gradient scale, you have him be not with viewpoints. You have him put viewpoints there and throw them away until he's sure he knows the difference. Have him be, for instance, on both sides of a cigarette. Very small space. I'll be on both sides of the cigarette. No, sir. No. Well, I can be on both sides of a crumb of tobacco. And here you go. You can eventually get him to be in San Francisco and be here. And that finally cures his major psychosis. And this is a psychosis with a thing. I don't care how well off the fellow is. He's nuts as long as he thinks he's just one place. He's really goofy. That's where you creep up to and break the next rung. As long as he's only one, he has this guard trouble I was talking to you about this morning. You know, wouldn't it be nice if he had two bodies, but he'd have to put one in the vault? No, no. Have him be in one body and be asleep. And be in another body and operate. Now, he could do that with great ease and shift that way without leaving either body. See, but the next one up that he would run into and balk at would be in both bodies fully attentive. And he'd find out he had an attention problem. He doesn't know which how do you run both of these? But he's mine simultaneously. I ran into this problem myself, and I know what I am talking about. And for about 5 days, without any help from anybody, I was practically daffy. Finally, at the end of about 7 days or something like that, just gave it up. Gave it up. Just threw in the sponge. Just got completely disgusted. And so forth, and started running one muck up at one time. But for the space of 5 days there, I was almost went batty, and then the space of 2 days did successfully run two muck ups simultaneously. And at the end of those 2 days, I threw in the sponge on it again, and I was so befuddled about the whole thing, and my attention units were so crossed up, that it wasn't until, oh, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 weeks went by, and I went back and picked up that doll. I was using another doll. The dolls get thrown away rather easily. They're quite easy to manufacture. And you find dolls around the universe. You just run one experimentally. And it was great concentration. I was able to get this doll picking up monotonously grains of sand and putting them aside. You see. And I'd be there watching the doll do this monotonous operation. But each time, putting a grain of sand just a little bit further out, so that we would get an eventual difference of motion of the doll. Because the problem was how to create two motions and observe differently two different sets of motions simultaneously. And a practice started also out on the highway, driving two cars. I tell you, Homo's that, needn't worry. He's not quite conscious. And it's the easiest thing in the world. Most people driving along are doing something inattentive like that and so forth. It's just to sit up and steer the car and speed it up and slow it down and so forth. He's driving all automatically anyhow. He's got a ridge sitting there. And if you put a beam on his ridge and just short circuit his automatic driving ridge to the dead end of the car battery or to the frame, he stops driving the car and doesn't ever know that he stops driving the car because nobody calls it to his attention. He's real low on attention. His attention is just almost not there at all.
This lecture is continued on side two of this cassette.
You try to drive two cars simultaneously. You try to do this and try to do that. I was trying to work this thing out so you can get back to where I felt I was doing something. I finally got this doll sorting out these grains of sand, sorting them out. Now it got real hot, and I got two dolls doing it, sorting them out. But it only worked as long as one was sorting out pebbles and the other was sorting out grains of sand. And then I finally got so two dolls would sort out grains of sand. I could tell which doll was sorting out which grain of sand at which moment, and what I was doing, where I was. At that time, I almost blew up, however. Came back down to one markup. Mostly because I was simply trying to work out the drills that one would go through. I had no further interest in the problem. But there's where effort comes in. There is where you get thought into effort and get thought and effort all mixed up. That's two attentions simultaneously. And it's baffling, very baffling. You feel just as a Satan, like you've got to sort of set your teeth. You can get that's the mess phrase that goes along with it. You set your teeth as a Satan, you see. And get this emotion over here. Get this one going over here. And then sit there and look cross-eyed. Well, that's the hard way to do it. That's the very hard way to do it. But that was just in the process of running drills. So it's no wonder that a fellow drifts down to the only one. Furthermore, this is a bombardment universe. And we'll come into what's wrong with that. That's just an aside. There are methods of doing this, which are much easier. As I just showed you, you just do it on a gradient scale, which is what I found out eventually. You have a fellow be in two places at once, and you get him very expert at being in 50 places simultaneously, viewing each one of them with great interest. And then you get him into motion and action in a couple of places. And he finds it very easy to do. But that's SOP 80. It's very easy to keep track of two motions when you can be in all these places simultaneously. But you start moving something in two places at once and keep track of two automobiles and two roads and two different sets of state laws. And one time I did this on driving a car on the left-hand side of the street in London and a car on the right-hand side of the street someplace else. Anybody who listens to this tape doesn't know Scientology, they think I'm crazy. Well, I thought I was for a while. Two different sets of traffic laws, two different concentrations. Now, a man can change his patterns of motion and action as much as he has lots of attention. So what about the fellow who is pinned in his head? What about this guy? Basically, he's having problems with havingness. Space is uncertain, and solidity is certain. So he avoids space and its uncertainty in favor of any material certainty which he can touch. All right? So far, so good. But you understand that once a person has done this, he's hitting into the GE's squirrel cage. He's hitting into the GE very badly. because the GE believes that his main attention should be down. That's gravity. And he is not only short on attention, the GE is fixed in attention. Completely fixed. And you hit a dwindling spiral. Now, this is a bombardment universe. Every time you turn around, there's another set of waves hitting any object. Anytime you want some randomity, you can find some more types of waves which are incoming. If you said this is an incoming universe, you'd certainly be right. Messed eyes, if they saw it all, would depend upon photons bouncing off something and coming toward one. Well, those photons actually accumulate. They actually hit the individual. It believes it's under a bombardment, you see, any piece of mist. And I think after something has been standing there, you canceled out the erosion factor. After something has been standing there so long, it would probably have more mass in this universe. You'd probably gain mass. Just because of this constant bombardment. Now you take sound. Sound hits you 360 degrees. Right? They're all the way around the periphery. It doesn't just hit the ears. A person is always in the middle of a sphere of sound. Always. If I stop talking here for a moment, you think this is a silent room. Well, just listen to the sounds in it. Now, get how many directions those are coming from. That's 360 degrees away. Now, in such a wise, you have light. Light does the same thing. All other things. I'm not trying to validate this new inflow barrier, but there's why the Thetan apparently dwindles in size, dwindles in space, and dwindles on down. Well, he starts fighting being the center of such a sphere. And, of course, he really isn't any bigger than that. See, there's the joke. He starts fighting his own size. So first he starts expanding outwards, and then his next step is to contract inwards. And these are on a spiral basis. And his next motion, you see, this is not fast. He starts expanding outwards on the basis of years, you see. And then he gets out to a certain limit, and he starts contracting inwards, and does that for years. And then he'll try to expand outward again, and does that for years. And then he tries to come inward again, and does that for years. So that you get the mystic belief in concentric shells of beingness. If you've ever heard of that. But they actually exist. They can be perceived. But what is being perceived isn't quite what they said it was. They thought it was the shells of experience. In other words, you had a life, and then you got another shell. And you had a life, and you got another shell, and so forth. The point is that they do have concentric shells. And it's what is the significance of these concentric shells that ball them up? Not are there concentric shells around being. And you'll find that street clears who are having difficulty exteriorizing have sets of shells inside their own heads. There's sort of a little being, you know, it's this little shell, and then there's a little bit bigger shell, a little bit bigger shell. They often can just sense these things. They're ridges. What kind of ridges? Well, as a Thetan, they have resisted. They've begun to resist something. And then it has eventually overwhelmed them. Well, as long as they were resisting it, they were going out toward it. And in the case of a 360-degree sphere, they simply developed a larger sphere than themselves. A Thetan is his own size. And he fights being made smaller. This is, you see, nonsense, because he can't be made any smaller. He is his own size. He conceives himself to be about the size of a small navy bean or a small pea or something like that. And he wouldn't get any smaller or any bigger if he lived to be 80,000 billion years old, except as he builds up ridges and calls those himself. Hence the genus of the body. A body is as big as the average impacts it has received over the evolutionary line. That is a direct law which modifies evolution. It is designed. Don't ever think that a body isn't designed. They are designed. Darwin, running around, did a wonderful job in most respects, but he himself sort of exhibited the evidence of the tail when he started talking about natural selection. You know, that's the mess. Universe does it all, does it all, does it all. Let's all be scientific, scientific, and mud, mud, mud. Because he said that it would be the difference of climates. It was the survival of the fittest. And I had that explained to me one day. There was family had a number of cats had kittens. One cats had kittens, and one kitten had more fits than the other. Others, and the rest of the cats, kittens died, but that one there that had more fits than the others, it lived. So that's the survival of the fittest. So we got the thing figured out finally, so it did make sense. When anybody comes along and tells you that something exists without a basic design, but if somebody, there's no pattern, he says there isn't any shape, beauty is by accident, all things are just the combination of old forms, and nobody thought it up, everything just sort of happened, and the reason life's on Earth is because there was a sea of ammonia and it generated some H+6O gel, and this combined accidentally with a virus, and that made everybody virulent. And this conclusion has been reached so many times by men who should know better. It's been reached by men who wouldn't drive a car, who wouldn't actually drive a car with no gasoline in it. It's been reached by men who would be otherwise reasonable in their actions, and yet they get into a classroom and they go mad. They go mad. They say ammonia and so on, and there's the virus, and it just all strung it, and there was spontaneous frogation. Occurred all over the universe, and that's life. You don't think you're mud. We're going to fix your clock. Have you joined the Communist Party lately? It's the next line to that, by the way. They have to make people believe they're mud. Basic design. A body would never have achieved anything even vaguely resembling beauty or have any beautiful attribute, whether the body of a butterfly or a human being, unless there was some intention toward beauty. And I've never seen a beautiful impact. I've heard impacts described as a beautiful impact when struck by somebody like Joe Lewis in the old days, but I've just never seen really what was actually a beautiful impact. But I have seen some beautiful designs. So running along with all these other modifying factors, and actually prior to, senior to, the modifying factors are design factors. Intentional design factors. So we have all of life following along on this basis. Now what a person believes he can create is modified by impacts. Let's take a body. A body gets pretty slammed around. You start engaging in any of the indoor sports of Earth, such as war. You start doing any of its parlor games, such as Prohibition, you get a series of impacts of one kind or another, which are none of them to the enhancement of beauty. In fact, I've never heard it said that anybody went through a war and became beautiful. Now, men have said many silly things, but they've never gotten that silly. And this deterioration of the design and a conviction, not just a feeling that, but a complete conviction that he himself cannot or must not design beauty is the sorrow of the having this problem of the 4, 5, 6, and 7. That's what makes it bad. They can have or not have, and so on, but could they shift the basic design? Well, they're convinced they can't shift the basic design. And this is how solidly that basic design has been pressed upon man. They don't think they could make a body more beautiful. They don't think they could make a beautiful body. They think in terms of, and you take some business executive, he thinks in terms of having a new letterhead. He doesn't reach for a pencil ordinarily and a crayon or a brush and design himself a new letterhead. No, sir, he sends for an artist. That's a specialized function. And if you watched him very closely while he did this, he would heave a slight sigh. He has not lost anything, according to him. He just can't do it. That's because people wouldn't be pleased with the design that he designed. All these things he's terribly convinced of. Now, maybe this fellow's lost a lot of his looks, something like that. Well, the ability to create beauty and the ability to create, for our purposes, are the same statement. That's the same statement. The ability to create beauty and the ability to create. If you make sex nasty enough, the whole race will degenerate aesthetically. Why? Because that's the communication system of more bodies for the future. See that? And there is essentially a creative function which is done by the GE. And if the GE is disabused of this and he's restrained in all directions, why, it starts to look like Mr. Freud had a point. It would be unfortunate for our race, however, if Mr. Freud did have the point on the subject which monitored our future behavior. He had a point about the GE. Everything he said's right about the GE. We're not processing GEs. And it's an insufficiently high enough echelon to reach into any level of processing which will restore creative function. Once you have restored the sexual creative function, by logic alone, it should follow that one's other capabilities should rise. See, by logic alone. It is so thoroughly believed that this takes place that in more medieval times, a group known as the psychoanalysts would very often advise a female patient to go out and have promiscuous intercourse. This was routine. Now, this doesn't follow, however, because they're not striking at basic creativeness. They're talking about duplication through a sexual communication line. That's all very well. And once in a while, somebody does get some spark of creativeness because of something like that. But I ran into a fellow one time that had met a beautiful girl and was terribly stimulated and satisfied sexually. And, you know, he was a writer, and he wasn't doing a tap of work. Not a tap. And he just had a wonderful time for himself for 3 or 4 months until she ran off with a butcher or a millionaire or something, the way girls do around Greenwich Village. And he went into the complete doldrums and gave it all up for over a week and then got back on the job. I was doing a good job after that. And reversely, I've seen it work the other way around. Spotty, you see, unpredictable. So that we don't have duplication via the sexual line being the answer to this. But we do have creativeness. The reason, the main difference of this is the creation of the sexual sensation is not the creation of the sensation which we call beauty. It's a condensation of the sensation we call beauty. Sexual sensation is a condensation of beauty. Terrifically condensed. Well, now, when it begins to hoard, though, in a society, and when creativeness in general is frowned upon, it is quite normal and routine and usual to find on every hand that men's creative abilities, the creative abilities of women have to a marked and large degree degenerated, so they have no further belief in their own ability to make anything better aesthetically. It does no good to tell such a person the bald truth of the matter. A GE can, that is a body, can actually be patched up if you're very careful about it and so on. It can be patched up. It occasionally, if you were good enough and interested enough, you could actually remake some of its anchor points and redesign and change and get it into perfect static balance. Oh, what a job this is, by the way. The fellow that first designed these bodies, my hat is off to him. What a terrific job of super balance and counterbalance and so forth. And it is possible to return to them something vaguely resembling their native beauty or enhancement of that beauty. But let's take the body after it's gone up to a rather high point of no return. Oh, let's say 70, something like that, 80. We're getting up there. When we start to work on our Freakler, no. Well, that's a real rough job. The capability of Freakler doesn't rise as it should, and they have different agreements as to how they should do this, and the way they should do this is just jettison this mock-up and get another one, they think. And they're fighting right there on the agreement track with everything they try to do about the body. But you take somebody who is 35, 40, 45, somewhere in that bracket. If you're working real fast and so forth, well, you're getting to put his body back together pretty well. Still function real good. But to change the aesthetic factor of a body is spotty in results. And sometimes very unsatisfactory. Because it takes the creative ability of the thing. Now, by the time you've pushed him up to a point where you can simply mock up a mock-up that everybody can see and walk around with it, by the time you've pushed him up to that point, what's the idea of repairing a GE? He only gets stuck when he gets a body that is well recognized. See, and then he's stuck with an identity. He doesn't dare change it too much. If he changed it too much, nobody'd know what the hell it's all about. He might as well go get another body. There you've got a problem on your hands. You'll run into that in anybody whose identity has become valuable, or he's trying to do something because of an identity. You get into trouble then. He tried getting to change his body very much, and he won't. But the good sense of the fact of recognition. He doesn't want the difference of recognition. Might not have anything to do with him with as far as attention was concerned. He just doesn't want to give a shift of identity, which would be so marked and so pronounced that, one, it would defeat his own identification, and two, would impede his own existence. No, the thing for you to do, and the way you solve that problem, of course, when a fellow gets up there, is to chase him on out someplace, some other universe, some other state, get his attention concentrated in various directions. Let him run a pretty mark-up someplace. Very soul-satisfying. See, that's real easy. Let's get back to this creativeness and creative ability and what it has to do with havingness. A person is only satisfied, really, with havingness, which he can consider beautiful. But understand that a five, having lost his ability to create beauty, he feels, may very well lose something else. His ability to have beauty just as such. Desire it, yes, he can do that somewhat secretly. But have it, well, it's something he'd have to waste. And it's about the most important thing that you could waste on a case, oddly enough, to somebody who's having a terrific time with having this. Now, these very, very tiny little points. The very fact, you see, if he couldn't have beauty, was the one thing he couldn't have. And you say, now look, we're going to exteriorize you and get you in good shape, and then you can patch yourself up. He can't have any point in it, you see, because he can't have beauty. See? So there'd be no point in patching him up. But he's right along the groove, very responsive on this particular point. If you waste beauty in brackets, and if you place beauty into the scenery with such a person, you'll very often break them out of the effort band. Real weird. Very interesting. Particularly if you waste the ability to create beauty. Waste the ability to create beauty. And so forth. Now, that's not a fast road toward exteriorization. But when a person, over and over, on the first three steps, doesn't exteriorize, then there is something wrong with his havingness. And the first thing there is wrong with it is that it isn't beautiful, and he can't have beauty. That's usually the first thing that clues with an auditor. There is a thing called shame of beauty. At this level on earth, they hardly understand it. I mean, that's why we could say shame beauty. Yes, I know that's something beautiful. But listen, there can be beauty to such a degree that a feeling of tremendous shame sweeps over anyone beholding it. What's the shame? See? It's simply this. He realizes he is not that beautiful. Now, a woman could be so sufficiently beautiful that she could walk through the worst den of thieves and amongst the most rowdy rabble on earth with complete safety and command. It's pathetic, however, today to see some, quote, beautiful woman, unquote, being run by a Thetan who can't have beauty. And this is so much the case that it quite often happens that a beautiful woman is about as safe to have around as a couple of cobras, because this person can't have her own beauty. That's what you run into in processing some very, very, very good-looking man or some tremendously beautiful woman. They can't have their beauty, so they turn themselves into kind of accident problems or anything, you know. They're ashamed of their own beauty. Now we get with a five, they're completely exteriorized easily, these beautiful people. But get a five, six, seven. It's very often this kind of a conflict with him. He doesn't want to know what he looks like. He feels he looks much worse than he is. His idea of his own appearance would rival anything put out by Cruikshank in many cases. He believes he's horrible. He really can't quite understand how people can look at him without commenting on it, and that kind of makes him feel like they're somewhat nice because they don't. He doesn't see himself. He shut off his vision originally because of beauty, because of a desire to agree with beauty and not look at anything else. And he, of course, started fighting ugliness. And blackness is the antithesis of beauty. And so we have blackness covering up beauty, and he uses, sees, then if he fights ugliness, he eventually winds up with blackness. But he's long since departed from the concept of beauty. The five doesn't know how he looks. And he will exteriorize with effort. And the hands-on-the-shoulders technique is your best method. He's going to do everything with effort. There's why he has another body, the inflow, so forth. Also, he's got a body in reserve, probably less beautiful than the body. And the inflow, he's going to fight against that by having another body, and so forth. So you ask him to do things with effort, and he can do things with effort. But if you just ask him to do things by thinking about it, he knows that's impossible because he's thought too many blocks of stone. They didn't move. And he's thought all sorts of things. Nothing happened. And so you ask him to think his way out of his head, and he'll just sit there and figure. That's all he can do. All right, what is this, in essence, this method of exteriorization? It's picking up what is essentially wrong with the case. It would ordinarily be found the person who is very difficult to exteriorize has a highly aberrated idea of how he looks. And beauty is mainly what's wrong. Now, I have to point that up. There can be other things wrong, you see, that are quite obvious. I mean, they become obvious on the e-meter. He's so worried about his daughter, you know, and his whole goal of life is toward making his daughter succeed or something like that, you know. You just can't get this guy squared away because he's hardly, his attention is not himself at all or where he is. This doesn't seem to make any difference. He's got too fixed an attention on something else. But that little specter of beauty might be one which would slip by you. It might slip by you because of some feeling of courtesy or discourtesy, or that it'd be impolite to run wasting beauty on someone. Well, believe me, it's not. They don't know how they look. I have seen a rather good-looking young man, for instance, completely bog on this point. He wept. He knew he was one of the most horrible-looking beasts that ever lived. He was just utterly convinced of this. There was nothing else he knew as well as that. And what do you know? He had three of the ugliest sisters you ever laid your eyes on, and they had just beaten it into him day and night. How ugly he was, and how beautiful they were. So he was all mixed up. I saw beauty with him, as far as that's concerned. He's made him waste beauty and have beauty, and waste things that created beauty, and waste machinery that created beauty, and waste things that unmock beauty, and all of a sudden he's... Well, if I do look fat, it doesn't make any difference. Let's see. Sometimes he gets so curious as to how he looks that his inverse vector, that is to say he comes when he should go, his inverse vector will not permit him to get out and take a look at himself. He is afraid of being confronted with Mr. Hyde. And he's very startled very often to find out he's just another Jekyll. So it has a great deal to do with it. Creativeness. In theta clearing, you're essentially creating a new situation for him. You're asking him to create continually. When he can't create, the trouble lies straight away with beauty. This will first manifest itself as trouble on the second dynamic, and second manifest itself, but much more importantly, on the subject of beauty and aesthetics themselves. And that you must rehabilitate with this case.